Hello, and welcome to another edition of KUAR's Week in Review podcast. On the program this week,
two vice presidential candidates exchange verbal punches in their first and only debate. Meanwhile, Arkansas's junior U.S. Senator Tom Cotton visits Iowa, 2020 on the mind.
A man dies in a Texarkana jail. A newly released video shows a struggle with guards and pleas of "I can't breathe."
Oil and gas industry representatives mingle with Arkansas politicians in Little Rock, from whence doth the energy flow.
An invasive beetle further endangers ash trees in Arkansas.
And a celebrated East Arkansas Blues Festival kicks off, finding Helena's place in blues history.
This is your last weekend to register to vote for the November 8th general election if you haven't yet. And this is KUAR's Week in Review podcast. I'm Chris Hickey.
And I'm Jacob Kaufman.
All right, Jacob. Well, this week we had our vice presidential debate. Of course, we're about exactly a month away from the November 8th general election. Of course, the big race is the U.S. presidential race between Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Hillary Clinton. Their running mates, vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine, the senator from Virginia and former governor, squared off against Mike Pence, the governor of Indiana and former congressman. You know, these two figures don't have a lot of name recognition on the national stage, at least compared to their running mates, but both have very kind of traditional political careers. They had a debate this week, and it was their first and only debate of this campaign season. Not as many people tuned in nationwide compared to the presidential debate the week before. Mm-hmm. And the two were sitting at desks, and they exchanged, you know, some words. And what was your take on it?
Right. Well, you know, the question from the vice presidential debate on every news channel, and it's, you know, like, it's too much. But it's always, will the vice presidential debate change how people view the candidates at the top, since they'll be the next heartbeat away from being in office? And, you know, I think the actual answer from most political scientists is, no, it probably won't change a lot, but it's still interesting to watch, and you get to learn about the candidates, even if it doesn't really influence a lot of voters.
Right, yeah.
I watched the debate on television, streaming from my PlayStation 4. And Chris, you listened to it on the radio, right?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
So we had a little bit different experience, because I was watching the split screen thing that they do now for the entire debate long, pretty much. They're sitting down at chairs, for instance, not standing up at podiums, so it's a little bit different. Mm-hmm. Tim Kaine was taking notes oftentimes. Tim Kaine especially was staring at him intently, ready to pounce all the time. He interrupted Mike Pence a lot. I guess he learned that from Donald Trump, that it's okay to interrupt in a debate a lot.
Yeah, it's interesting how those roles seem kind of reverse. In this case, you know, we had Mike Pence kind of sitting back, mm-hmm, and kind of calmly responding to a lot of things. Maybe not always calmly responding, but you had Tim Kaine
seen his face
interrupting, going into it. Yeah, well, I didn't.
You know, I guess a few things stood out to me. One, that Kaine was kind of maybe too aggressive and too interrupty for most people's taste, probably. Kaine's successful strategy throughout the night, I thought he would quote Donald Trump for saying something, you know, offensive that he said in the past about some various group or person, and then Pence would go, "Oh, Donald Trump never said that," or he would say, "Oh, I don't know, absolutely not." So I thought that was a good part, because Kaine kept on bringing it up. He would say, like, throughout this debate, we've seen Mike Pence refuses to defend the words or whatever of his running mate and stuff like that. And on the tax return question, he had a pretty good zinger. He said, like, when you were selected as vice president, Donald Trump looked at your tax returns, because that's what people need to see to be vetted properly. So,
yeah.
But I think
still a thorn in the side of that campaign, for sure.
I think Pence might have probably won on the Iran deal and on the Russia stuff. I don't think Kaine really landed any punches, but I think Mike Pence was pretty good about saying the Iran deal isn't good, it didn't really work.
Which is kind of interesting in a way, because I think Tim Kaine sits on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and his running mate Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State. So you'd think that, you know, they'd be able to kind of win on matters of foreign policy, at least in argument's sake. But I guess this wasn't the case this time.
But also, then again, maybe none of it really matters. It just was kind of interesting to watch if you're into politics, and you got to learn more about their personalities and some of their viewpoints on some things. My favorite joke moment was that Pence's response at some points to Kane were, "Are you kidding me? We're an insult-driven campaign. You're the insult-driven campaign." And within like a few minutes of that, Donald Trump tweeted that Tim Kaine looks like a Batman villain.
Well, while this is going on, the presidential election, Jacob, you noticed that our junior senator, Tom Cotton, is traveling and has been in Iowa. What is this all about?
Or will be in Iowa.
Will be in, oh, okay.
So he's going to headline two big Republican fundraisers in Iowa, as reports the Des Moines Register, one of the big newspapers up there. And these fundraisers are not for Donald Trump, the person at the top of the ticket. As we know, Tom Cotton, as well as most Arkansas Republicans, aside from Attorney General Leslie Rutledge, have been pretty tepid about the endorsement of Donald Trump. You know, Tom Cotton's certainly not a guy who shies away from the international or national stage. He, you know, seems like he really relishes getting his opinion and viewpoint across, but virtually totally quiet about Donald Trump. We might remember the convention speech, Republican National Convention. I think he only said Donald Trump's name once, and maybe even he just said a Trump-Pence ticket. He didn't even say Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. So these fundraisers are for state-level candidates, some of them, state senators and the like. And there's five other events planned with various Republican officials and candidates while he'll be there in Iowa. So who knows? But, you know, everyone likes to say, ooh, what's next for 2020?
Perhaps and building an organizational structure for the 2020 Iowa caucuses. Yeah.
But, you know, in retrospect, I feel bad that we're talking about this at all, because we shouldn't be, and now we're contributing to the problem. So we apologize, podcast listeners.
Shame on us.
Let's switch gears a little bit, although I will point out, I guess, that the presidential debates and the vice presidential debate haven't focused too much on issues like judicial reform or police accountability. That hasn't been that popular compared to how popular it was in the Democratic debate, the law and order theme at the Republican convention. But a really horrific video was released this week from an incident that happened quite a while ago from a Texarkana jail. Chris, you're going to talk about this a little bit. It was a guy who was just in the jail for a little bit of time. It was a for-profit prison on the Texas-Arkansas.
Yeah, it's a bi-county jail between Miller County and Bowie County in Texas. They take in some inmates from the Arkansas side as well as the Texas side there in Texarkana.
Yeah, but this video, tell us about it. There was a I guess he was 30 or 40 years old.
Yeah, this 35-year-old Michael Sabi. Sabi, I think is how it's pronounced. He was arrested last year on a kind of a domestic disturbance call. A domestic disturbance call last July. I don't know exactly how long he was there, but the Huffington Post, which had been kind of investigating a lot of deaths in Texas jails, at least since the Sandra Bland incident. I don't know if you recall this black woman who came down from Chicago, was stopped in a city in Texas. A lot of people claim the situation escalated unnecessarily and she was arrested and was later found dead in her jail cell that week. That kind of set off the Huffington Post to kind of look at how other deaths in Texas jails were. And they came across this video that was captured by guards there in the Bowie County Texas Bi-State Jail. And it shows a dispute between this inmate, Michael Sabi, kind of a heavyset guy, 35 years old. You see in the video, he's kind of forced to the ground by several guards. I believe he was pepper sprayed. Mm-hmm. And you begin to hear there's audio in the video, and I'll play a little bit of this right here. And a word of warning, it is, you know, slightly disturbing for anybody who's sensitive to that sort of thing.
Oh, God. Please, it's warm. Please. 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 Please.
I got to tell.
Where? Oh. Oh, please, use the water.
Well, there, I mean, you can hear him kind of asking for water. He says there once, I can't breathe, but he says it even more often in the video.
He must have said it like 100 times.
Yeah. He also said he had pneumonia, but you see him in the video kind of being examined by a nurse or someone who's acting as a nurse. It's not really clear, you know, that it's like a really full medical examination.
Well, that was what was so strange to me. He went to be examined for the medical thing because the officers used force against him. So that's why they took him to the medical examiner. And the medical examiner, when he was there the whole time, his pants were down because there were, even though there were 8 or 10 officers, they wouldn't like do him the dignity of pulling his pants up for the longest time, even though he wasn't resisting at all. He was sitting there in the chair in that medical looking room, you know, like out of breath, saying, I can't breathe, please help me, give me some water. And all these officers are standing around, that nurse looking lady is standing around, and at no time does anyone ask him any questions or talk to him. And it's like, if you're having a medical exam and your patient's saying, I can't breathe, you'd think that responsible medical response would be to say, oh, you can't breathe or something, you know, to respond to that in some way. But instead they just threw him under his bed in his cell.
Yeah, it is interesting because it brings up questions about the training of the guards here. I mean, this bi-state prison is operated by LaSalle Corrections Corporation, which is a private prison company that we've heard, you know, the federal government has abstained from contracting further with private prison companies, but, you know, a lot of states still do. Arkansas does not. However, Arkansas Department of Correction does have a contract with Bowie County, Texas, to send state inmates there.
I listened to the report from Sabrina McCormick from the Texarkana public NPR station that she sent us that we had on air on Friday morning.
And it's on our website, KUAR.org.
Yes, that's right. And she was talking with the attorney, and apparently he had been complaining for several days that he was having trouble breathing or something like that. So one argument is that the guards thought, oh, well, he's faking it or something if he keeps saying it. The counter response is, well, oh, he's got a serious problem for multiple days.
Yeah.
But it kind of reminds me, there's a issue in the Boonville Human Development Center where someone choked to death on something despite the personnel there being told that this person was at risk of choking because they had a severe disability. But their argument from the staff was, well, this person had said that they were having trouble before and had faked it, so they didn't want to pay attention to it, and you have to take stuff seriously when people say they can't breathe.
Yeah. And so the death of Michael Sabby is, I mean, it's currently being investigated by the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division and the FBI. And as you mentioned, it, you know, there's a, you know, kind of a national attorney that litigates these wrongful death cases in prisons and around the country who's taking up the case for the family. And, you know, so it'll be, you know, we'll see, you know, what comes of this. I mean, it's impossible to speculate exactly what will become of it, but
I guess on the political side, of course, we have heard no reaction from any state officials.
Yep, we'll see.
All right. While we've got Texas on our mind, let's start thinking about Texas tea, talking about oil. Okay, so the there were two different oil and gas meetings in Little Rock. One was an interstate agency, so to speak, kind of different governors and states around the country. And there's also a trade association of Arkansas oil and gas producers, all met in Little Rock this week. Chris, why don't you tell us a little bit about this meeting? Our governor now heads this organization.
Yeah, he took over from Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon, who is also at the meeting. The Interstate Oil and Gas Compact Commission,
IOGCC,
represents, I guess, the state interests regarding the oil and gas industry around the country. Several states participate. But, you know, they had various seminars, speakers, you know, a few different elected representatives came to speak or be a part of panels, like 4th District Congressman Bruce Westerman was there, I believe, and a few others from the state legislature were there. But I think one of the big moments of this was a press conference held by Governor Fallon and Governor Hutchinson, just talking questions from the press on various topics relating to the oil and gas industry. You know, as you may know, in Oklahoma at least, there have been a number of earthquakes, a lot of seismic activity. A lot of scientists and geologists are pointing to these disposal wells from fracking operations in the gas industry as contributing to this increased seismic activity. And actually, we're not affiliated with this in any way, but State Impact Oklahoma, which is a reporting collaboration among public radio stations in Oklahoma, does this, a lot of energy news because it's such a important industry there, and it's created a lot of news for sure. And they have a wonderful website if you want to go and check out more. Just search for State Impact Oklahoma. You'll learn a lot. Anyways, in Arkansas, in the meanwhile, the gas industry, although we have, Southwestern Energy, for instance, has a big office here in Conway. The Fayetteville Shale for a number of years was producing a lot of gas, but recently, in recent years, it's made a huge downturn, largely because of the oversupply, I think, of natural gas on the market. Last week, the first drilling well for natural gas in the Fayetteville Shale started up. It's the only one right now after a couple of years of just steady decline. I think back in 2008 was the kind of the high point when there were 60 wells or approximately 60 wells in 2008 in Fayetteville Shale. Anyways, natural gas is just one piece of the energy pie. There's also, there were discussions about the Clean Power Plan, coal industry, this clean line, transmission line, which is supposed to carry wind energy from Oklahoma through Arkansas to Tennessee, was a major point of discussion at this press conference. And let me play a little bit of a clip of this. Our reporter, David Monteith, went to cover this, but, obviously he's not able to be here to join us to talk about it. But I listened to this press conference, and it's quite interesting, the kind of contrast between the two governors and what they thought about this clean line, which is a company based in Houston, which had proposed this transmission line to go across to carry wind energy. And first, we'll hear from Governor Mary Fallon answering a reporter's question about the clean line plan.
Of course, I support the clean line power plan and its transmission of exporting energy, wind power through Oklahoma. And as I've talked to Arkansas about, it can be an asset to you too in helping to bring alternative renewable energy into both of our states and our economy and certainly across the nation. It helps with our air emissions, as we all know, especially when it relates to the clean power plan. It helps us diversify our energy mix, which is always the top goal for Oklahoma, because when you're very dependent upon oil and gas and you have an energy downturn with low oil prices and low gas prices, it can really affect your state revenues. So we are now the fourth leading state in the nation in wind power with billions of dollars of investment in our state, which has helped us diversify our portfolio mix of energy in our state. But we're also an all-the-above energy strategy in the state of Oklahoma. So it's been good for us, and I'll let the governor speak for himself.
And now, before we play the governor's clip, we should mention that Arkansas's congressional delegation, I think, has been largely opposed to this clean line transmission plan, largely because of, the regulatory circumstances surrounding it. They believed it was a decision that should be kind of regulated by the states, whereas I think the federal Department of Energy has been taking the regulatory lead on this.
Because there are a lot of landowners that don't want these giant power lines going through their property is one of the main cases against it. Of course, there have been an oil pipeline approved recently that had the support of the congressional delegation that did the same thing, went across people's property, and people had the same objections.
In light of that context, here's Governor Hutchinson kind of talking about this clean line plan, what he thinks of it too.
No, it's it has been determined to be a federal regulatory issue, and Clean Line has received the federal authorization to build the transmission line. There has not been any role of the states to play in terms of that authority, and so that is has been accomplished at the federal level, and so there's not any position that's needed by me. Now, what I do advocate for, and I have expressed myself, is if we're going to have a transmission line going across Arkansas, then we want to have a benefit from it in terms of access to the transmission line for our receipt of some of that energy, and that would help us. They have allowed us to have that type of access to the transmission line, and so we will be receiving some of that energy, so there will be some benefit to Arkansas.
And so, you know, he takes a markedly neutral position, I guess, but he clearly states that he wants some of that energy from the Clean Line plan. So unlike our congressional delegation, which had been seemingly opposed to this, you know, he kind of removed himself from the debate.
It's kind of funny, though, to say, like, I can't comment on this. This is a federal issue. It's like that's the bread and butter Republican argument for stuff, is commenting on the federal government doing something that they shouldn't be doing.
Yeah.
So anyway, I want to mention about Oklahoma governor's, the Republican governor's comments. She talked about improving air emissions and about pursuing clean energy and diversifying their energy portfolio. Those are just things I've never heard like Arkansas politicians say.
yeah.
And this is a Republican governor.
Yeah, so, you know, kind of interesting to hear. I guess maybe one possible way to analyze that is just to say, well, you know, since natural gas has been kind of this weird, kind of precarious, kind of up and down industry there, that, you know, maybe she's like realized that in order to have some stability in the energy mm-hmm. industry, you have to have a multitude of different...
Yeah, different reality for Oklahoma.
It's been an unfortunate series of events that has led to the continued destruction of ash trees across the eastern United States and the southern United States due to this one pesky little pest called the emerald ash borer. And Jacob, we found out that this pesky little emerald ash borer is finding its way further into Arkansas, endangering our ash trees. What's going on?
Yes, Chris, it seems this tiny, tiny little green bug has made it all the way from Michigan in 2002, the first time it was in the United States, down to Arkansas, I think, two or three years ago. And now there's 8 more Arkansas counties have a quarantine, including Pulaski, for the emerald ash borer. The total's at 21, and another 12 counties have had confirmed sightings. So about half the state, there's some sort of quarantine. And it doesn't mean that you're banned from leaving the county under this quarantine, Chris. You can still go to Saline County if you want. But if you're transporting various wood products, then perhaps you might need to pay attention to the quarantine. So I spoke with Forest Health Specialist Chandler Barton with the Arkansas Forestry Commission. It's the Department of Agriculture and the Arkansas State Plant Board that issues these quarantines. And we've had the quarantines in place in some form for the past 2 years, but they've kept on adding more counties to it. Anyway, here's Chandler Barton talking about kind of what they can do to enforce a quarantine.
That's a tough thing to monitor, for sure. And the goal of the quarantine is to limit long-distance dispersal. We know that's how it gets into areas like the southern part of our state, is by human movement. So actually humans being involved in the movement of the insect causes it to move quicker and expand its range much faster than it would naturally. So the whole purpose of the quarantine is to limit that long-distance dispersal. And we can monitor some things. We can monitor the movement of wood to mills. So when foresters cut trees and put them onto a log truck, that gets monitored, and they have to comply with compliance agreements. Really, that's the one thing that we can keep a good eye on. Something that we have a lot of difficulty monitoring is firewood movement.
So there's 12 counties with confirmed sightings. These 21 now that are quarantine restrictions in place. And it seems like if you've got the quarantine in place, pretty much the emerald ash borer is here to stay.
So the eradication is difficult for most invasive insects because it moves so quickly and so aggressively. Emerald ash borer has gotten to a point where eradication is impossible. If we're able to catch an invasive insect very quickly before it establishes, it can be controlled to some respect. But at this stage in the game with emerald ash borer, eradication is not going to happen. Slowing the spread and raising awareness about it is what can happen. But yeah, controlling it, unfortunately, is beyond the point of no return.
So beyond the point of no return, stakes are pretty high for those ash trees populating Arkansas forests. In fact, the stakes are so high that it seems like the war is over.
You know, close or near distant future, we're going to see emerald ash borer throughout the state. It's going to affect most of the ash that we find in Arkansas. And unfortunately, it's going to functionally remove ash from our ecosystem. And that doesn't mean it's going to make ash extinct. It's just going to be pretty hard to find. In the long-term goal, we hope that once the beetle moves through, that maybe we can reestablish ash, a more immune ash that's actually crossed with a more resistant variety. So maybe in the very, very distant future, we can see ash in our forest again. But for the time being, we may have to worry about seeing it gone for a while.
So if you're an ash tree, it's like you're entering an era of apocalypse in Arkansas.
Yeah, things look pretty grim.
You know, in addition to the quarantine, hoping to slow the spread and stuff like that, and maybe it'd be in some parts of forest, but not all of it. We're in year two of a three-year kind of pilot-like program where they're introducing these Asian wasps that are predators of this beetle that don't live in North America until now that to combat. But the deal is that the ash trees in Asia are more resistant to this beetle because they've evolved together for hundreds of millions of years or whatever. And so there are predators there also for that that don't exist here.
Any idea of a timeline of like how long it could be until we see no more ash trees or where it will spread throughout?
I said, do you think within the next decade they'll be in every county? And he's like, yeah, probably. So right. I guess it'll take them a while to eat all the trees. But
yeah, well, too bad. Some light news here, but still kind of important to the region of East Central Arkansas, the Arkansas Delta, in the town of Helena.
Quite a region you created there.
In the town of Helena. The King Biscuit Blues Festival is coming up this weekend.
And 31st year.
The 31st year. Blues enthusiasts from around the country and probably around the world will descend on Helena, West Helena, and listen to some blues. I mean, and have a good time. Jacob, you talked with some folks who have been going to the festival and know a lot about it. What's the deal this year?
Yeah, so we always hear a little bit about the King Biscuit Blues Festival throughout the year. I talked to Kenneth King, who's recommended by our own operations manager, that's close to his title, William Wagner. His name is Kenneth King. He lives in Little Rock, and he's a filmmaker. He's filmed hundreds and hundreds of concerts, including many Sun Studios people who aren't exactly blues necessarily, but, you know, same world, certainly same part of the world. So my question was, you know, so many cities claim to have some sort of heritage or legacy. We see Walnut Ridge saying that, oh, we're the Beatles town because they landed their plane there one time. Yeah, it's like, okay, you're the Beatles town, that's fine.
Or was that place where the Rolling Stones got arrested or whatever?
Yeah, it's like, okay, you can kind of claim that to, you know, the Rock and Roll Highway or whatever. But so my question to him was, in his estimation, Kenneth King, where does Helena sit in the pantheon of blues cities?
It's next to Clarksdale. It's probably ground zero. I mean, I know that ground zero is what they call Clarksdale, but next to Clarksdale, because it was a cotton capital. And, you know, all the guys that came out of the fields, and they had the radio station that does the King Biscuit, you know, blues show. And,
to this day.
Yeah. Right. And some of the guys that I knew, like the Sun Studio guys, have told me stories. Like Paul Burleson, who's passed away now, he was in a rock and roll trio and did the first big version of the song Train Kept a Rollin'. He told me that like 1951, 52, when blacks and whites didn't mingle, that he would play with Howlin' Wolf on the radio. But he had to go in one door and Howlin' Wolf would go in the other because they couldn't go in the same door together, you know. So,
but they could be on the same airwave.
Yeah,
share the
yeah.
microphone, but they could
but
go on
music
the same
is like medicine, you know, and you give it to everybody or everybody needs it.
So everybody needs medicine. What's the health of blues these days? I think, as we all know, blues is not a popular music. You don't hear it on like Alice 107.7 in Little Rock. But, you know, there's still a lot of people that like it. I think last year there were around 30,000 or so people Helena itself only has about 15,000, so clearly a lot of people are coming in from outside of Helena to come see this in historic downtown Helena, which doesn't have as many businesses as it used to be. I asked Kenneth King, you know, if the prime of blues for the Helena area was early 40s through the 50s, you know, what's it like today? And he kind of said, well, there aren't a lot of big name acts left around today, simply because most of them are dead, that it's a little different, but he basically says that the quality is the same. There's still blues musicians playing bars all over the place.
I mean, they'll have like three or four maybe headliners at King Biscuit. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of them are just people that are just out working the bars trying to make a living, you know. And they bring them in, and that's like a lot of times it's, hey, I hadn't seen you since we played, you know. I mean, so it's like kind of like a family get-together backstage when you see some of these guys that haven't seen somebody in 10 or 15 years, and all of a sudden they're hugging, and it's kind of like, you know, like a family reunion kind of. But all the really, really good, the old blues guys are all gone. I mean, except Buddy Guy and Taj Mahal, and there's one or two others.
So anyway, I think last year they had Taj Mahal, who's like he was huge during the late 60s, kind of a second generation blues guy. Wasn't like Muddy Water. Well, I guess there's so many generations.
Yeah.
So, second electric guitars blues generation, maybe. But so this year, and B.B. King, of course, played there. He's got Arkansas roots. This year, headliners are still big people. They don't have big name recognition outside of the blues community. They're never people who truly crossed over. Here's one of them, Charlie Musselwhite. He is said to have inspired Dan Aykroyd's Blues Brothers character.
Here you come again with your big wide grin. You wanna get me back? Ain't gonna be like that.
So the Chicago Blues have made it to the Delta in some sort of reverse order, but that's fine. That's fine. There's Charlie Musselwhite and Sonny Landreth, and he is noted. He had a lot of involvement with Eric Clapton, including recording this song many years ago. This is him live in the current day.
Just watching him, he seems really intensely focused on the guitar.
This morning, people, look down from my shoe. You know I have the mean walking moon. Woke up this morning.
Treading some familiar blues territory, waking up in the morning, being despondent about something. But anyway, so it started on Thursday night. It runs through Saturday evening. They do it every year, so don't feel bad if you missed it this year.
All right. Thanks for listening to KUAR's Week in Review podcast.
Thanks for hosting, Chris.
No problem. Thanks for being a part of it as well and contributing. And thank you for listening. You are the reason we exist, listeners. We deeply value you.
Our sole purpose in life as well.
Yeah. If you have a comment or a question about this podcast or any of KUAR's news coverage, you can shoot us an email at news@KUAR.org. KUAR is a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, although we are editorially independent of that institution. You can find our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, NPR podcasts, whatever.
And we're also funded in part by the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, there's that too. Mm-hmm. And well, with that, have a good week and see you next week.
Have a good Columbus Day. We can talk about that in next week's podcast. Should we celebrate Columbus?
Yeah. And don't forget to register to vote again if you haven't already.
Tuesday's the deadline to mail it in. Get your postmark if you're registering.
Exactly. All right. Thank you. I'm Chris Hickey.
And I'm Jacob Kaufman.
See you next week.